More of Andrew Chaiken and Scott Hubbard on Planetary Radio Live. Welcome to the travel show that takes you to the final frontier. I'm Matt Kaplan of the Planetary Society. It's hard to believe Curiosity has already been on Mars for more than 2 weeks. It was the day before the exhilarating touchdown of the big rover that Planetary Radio Live went on stage at Planet Fest. This week we'll present more of the great panel discussion recorded there, which also included Planetary Society CEO Bill Nye, the science guy. Up first, our regular conversation with the Society's senior editor and planetary evangelist, Emily Lakdawalla. Emily, great to be talking to you again. It has been since PlanetFest that we last spoke.
Yeah, it has been a long time and a very busy couple of weeks.
Sure has. In fact, there is some news that is breaking. Even as we record this, we don't know much, but what do we know?
We do know that the next Discovery mission, which is the cheapest in NASA's multi-mission line, is going to be InSight. InSight is a Martian lander that's based upon the successful Phoenix lander, but instead of scooping at soil, it's going to drive a heat probe deep into the soil and also have a seismometer. So this is a geophysics mission.
So that's pretty cool. Now, of course, I and a lot of other people were hoping for the Titan choice, but this'll do.
Yeah, Titan boat would have been cool. And frankly, I like the Comet Hopper just as much. So it's really tough to make these choices. I am a little bit sad for the outer planet community, but I am looking forward to InSight. We're going to learn completely unique things from this mission.
And congratulations to everybody on the InSight team. Also, congratulations to everybody on the Curiosity team, which is already doing such an incredibly great job on Mars.
That's right. It's been a spectacular first couple of weeks. Now, as I'm talking with you, Curiosity hasn't yet moved, but it should be doing that soon. They did unstow the robotic arm for the first time today. They also used the laser on top of the robot's head to shoot at a rock for the first time yesterday. So they've been slowly testing out all the instruments. They're getting ready. They'll probably do their first drive this week. And we're going to get ready to go to a site where they might investigate some rocks that were laid down in an ancient lake on Mars.
Tell me a little bit more if you know anything about that first test of KenCam. Did they actually get some spectroscopic data out of this?
Well, they haven't said that yet. What they have done is you can actually see the little holes that they fired both at their calibration target, which is something on the rover, and at a tiny little rock on the ground, which has its own Twitter account, which was kind of hilarious to follow this weekend. The funny thing is, you know, every time it lasers a rock, it also shoots itself in the back.
What? I'm not sure I understand. Does it reflect back or something?
No. It's for calibration. So it carries other known rock samples that every single time it shoots a rock, it also shoots at least one of these rock samples so that they can do comparisons and make sure that they understand the instrument's performance very well.
I'll be darned. I will simply recommend at this point for anybody who hasn't seen it, the video tour that you provide of Curiosity's cameras. It is on the Planetary Society YouTube page and under videos at planetary.org. And you do mention KenCam as part of that collection.
It's quite a suite of instruments, that's for sure.
Emily, great to be talking to you once again, and I look forward to the next opportunity in a week.
All right, see you then, Matt.
She is senior editor and planetary evangelist for the Planetary Society, and along with many other things, including contributing editor to Sky and Telescope magazine. We'll be right back to take you back a couple of weeks, maybe a little bit more, to our PlanetFest celebration when we still weren't quite sure whether Curiosity would be the great success it has become. On Saturday, August 4, we were still a day away from knowing if Curiosity, the Mars Science Laboratory rover, would survive her 7 minutes of terror and become the newest ambassador from Earth to the Red Planet. I had welcomed three of Earth's most enthusiastic Martians to the stage at the Planetary Society's Planet Fest celebration in Pasadena. We started listening to the session last week and will continue it now. You can hear nearly an additional half hour of this fascinating conversation online at planetary.org/radio. That's in the podcast version of our show. Let's rejoin space historian Andrew Chaiken, Bill Nye the Science Guy, and former NASA Mars czar Scott Hubbard on that exciting evening. Scott Hubbard has just published Exploring Mars, a terrific new book about his 10 years at the agency. He had just told us about the tough decision he made to cancel the Mars sample return mission in the year 2000.
That was tough. That was very hard. But you apparently managed to get things back on track. That was also against some odds, but you laid out some very important principles. You had a ladder to Mars.
Yes, I said that rather than just going at every opportunity with an orbiter and a lander no matter what, we had to structure a scientific program that made sense. And to really advance the understanding of Mars as a system, you needed to go to orbit, do some reconnaissance, then go to the surface and get ground truth and check it out, then go with a more capable orbiter and a more capable rover. So it's not an accident that we went from a little toaster oven-sized Pathfinder rover to the 1,900-pound Curiosity. That was built into the program so that we continuously advanced our capability.
Do you think we are now where you had hoped we would be when you started this effort 12 years ago?
I really think so. I think, and for people in radio land, I'm holding my fingers about a quarter of an inch apart. I think we're this close to understanding habitability of Mars. So with the...
What do you mean habitability?
The understanding of whether or not Mars was ever an abode for life. Maybe it could be today. The combination of energy and liquid water and the thing that Curiosity is going to look for, which is organic material, complex carbon compounds that are the fingerprints of life.
Andy, are we where you would have hoped we would be here in 2012? Because you've been thinking about this for a long time.
You know, I've had to go through so many cycles of hope and despair and sort of resignation, and I'm back being hopeful. I have to say mostly because of what I see in private companies like SpaceX, who are rethinking the problem of how you do spaceflight in a way that is sustainable and affordable. And that is something that NASA, I would have hoped, could have done long ago. It didn't work out that way. I'm glad it's happening now. And I, at the same time, I'm so conscious of the fact that Mars is a kind of a Mount Everest for the human species. And the more I find out about the difficulties of going to Mars with humans and even with robots, I mean, I'm going to be watching tomorrow night when Curiosity lands, and I'm going to have my hands over my eyes pretty much, because even though I think it's going to work, it's going to be terrifying. And I know how hard this stuff is. But, you know, I'll just tell you one little piece of the humans to Mars part of this that I didn't know. I was talking to a former NASA engineer who said to me, you know, if they're on their way to Mars and the toilet breaks, everybody dies. And he explained to me, because the toilet on a Mars ship is a crucial part of recycling water and nutrients. You can't possibly bring all of the stuff you need to survive a 2.5-year voyage to Mars, a year on the surface and then back is 2.5 years. And so that is so far beyond what we're able to do. And let me just, I know I'm going in about five directions at once here, but let me just add one more element to this. I'm concerned for us as a society, because I don't think that we as a culture understand how magnificent what is happening right now and what is going to happen tomorrow night, even if it doesn't work, God forbid. We are the world leaders in something that is absolutely mind-boggling, and the fact that we have the creativity and the ingenuity to go solve these questions about what it's like on Mars, what it was like billions of years ago, to build these machines, these incredible machines, and figure out how to make them work and operate a couple hundred million miles away from the Earth. That, to me, is one of the most magnificent human stories. It is a magnet for young people to go into science and engineering. And I have a terrible fear that we don't see what we have and we're going to throw it away.
Bill, you talk a lot about maintaining that leadership.
This is my worship paragraph these days is, the investment in planetary science is such a good value that it's a few hundred million a year, and what you get changes everything. It is what I like to call trickle-up economics, where you invest in a NASA center, and they hire some people, and they start in on this extraordinary thing. Well, then the high school nearby gets an infusion of science and engineering, and then that affects the teachers that want to come to work there, then that affects the elementary schools, and that affects the people that move into that neighborhood, and then that eventually affects the local university, and then the university gets better grants, and the grants are more sophisticated, and then the people who are graduated from those universities go on to start their own enterprises in that area instead of going somewhere else, and the world has changed. And so what is wonderful about planetary science is it brings out the best in us because it is so difficult.
Scott, are people going to follow?
I think so. You know, the robots go first. They do our dull, dirty, dangerous work. I think that humans will go. And I think that it is, in fact, in our nature to go out and explore. Not everybody does. Some people are perfectly happy staying nearby. But other people want to see what's over that next horizon. I think that is something that's built into human nature. And I see human beings going to Mars. One of the big questions is, of course, that I always hear, is it a one-way trip or a two-way trip? I think if the government is sponsoring it, it will be we're going to send a person there and return them safely. But there are people out there that are suggesting that maybe we ought to colonize with a one-way trip.
Yeah, let's do a scientific poll. How many of you would get on a one-way rocket to Mars? Maybe a quarter of our crowd.
More of our Planet Fest discussion about the how and why of exploring Mars with Scott Hubbard, Andrew Chaikin, and Bill Nye is a minute away. This is Planetary Radio.
I'm Robert Picardo. I traveled across the galaxy as the Doctor in Star Trek Voyager. Then I joined the Planetary Society to become part of the real adventure of space exploration. The Society fights for missions that unveil the secrets of the solar system. It searches for other intelligences in the universe, and it built the first solar sail. It also shares the wonder through this radio show, its website, and other exciting projects that reach around the globe. I'm proud to be part of this greatest of all voyages, and I hope you'll consider joining us.
You can learn more about the Planetary Society at our website, planetary.org/radio, or by calling 1-800-9-WORLDS. Planetary Radio listeners who aren't yet members can join and receive a Planetary Radio t-shirt. Our nearly 100,000 members receive the internationally acclaimed Planetary Report magazine. That's planetary.org/radio. The Planetary Society, exploring new worlds.
Welcome back to Planetary Radio. I'm Matt Kaplan. We're presenting more of our Planet Fest discussion about the exploration of Mars, recorded on August 4, the day before Curiosity successfully landed there. My guests on stage were Scott Hubbard, NASA's Mars czar until a couple of years ago, Planetary Society CEO Bill Nye, and space historian and author Andrew Chaikin. Andy grew up in the space age and even participated in the Viking landings on Mars back in 1976 when he was still not much more than a kid. You can read about it in his great book, A Passion for Mars. I asked him about an even earlier inspiration.
Andy, could you take us back a few years and just mention something that you were a big part of some years ago called Mars in the Mind of Man?
Oh, boy. That is one of my formative experiences. I was in high school. I was in my senior year of high school in 1973 when a book was published called Mars in the Mind of Man. And that book was basically a transcript of a symposium that had been done at Caltech on the eve of Mariner 9's arrival at Mars and becoming the first spacecraft to orbit Mars and subsequently revealing Mars to be a geologic wonderland, a world that, contrary to what the previous flybys had suggested, was not only a moon-like expanse of craters, but was home to the largest volcano in the solar system, to a canyon system that would stretch nearly the length of the continental United States, and to ancient river valleys, and many, many more wonders of geology. And in this panel discussion, in addition to Bruce Murray, who was one of the leading Mars scientists in the world.
One of the founders of the Planetary Society.
That's right. And the other founder of the Planetary Society, Carl Sagan, was the man who I now call the poet laureate of space exploration, Ray Bradbury. And it was in the pages of that book, not only in the transcript, but in the essay that Ray wrote in the foreword to the book and in the afterthoughts, that I fell in love with him and made him my mentor. And I am so grateful to have had the chance to have worked with him back in 2000 when I was the editor of a magazine called Space Illustrated. And I commissioned an essay from him which was called Too Soon from the Cave, Too Far from the Stars.
We do have a question from the audience. Hi, sir. Introduce yourself.
Hi, I'm Brandon Gina from Michigan Tech, actually, a college student. So what I'm interested in, and I guess open to any of you, what makes Mars a more important target for missions than, say, Europa or Titan?
What a great question.
Yeah, and the other interesting places in the solar system.
Scott, would you tackle that first?
Sure. Well, Mars is the most Earth-like of all the planets in the solar system, and therefore the consensus of the science community is that it is perhaps the most likely to have ever had life or possibly have life today. And an additional practical factor is you can get there for a 20-day window every 26 months. Europa is also compelling, but it's much, much further away. So that's why we have invested this last decade in understanding Mars, and I think, frankly, we're ready to now bring some well-selected samples back.
Andy, Mars, Europa, why not both?
Because the real world says that's not an option. I mean, there was a cartoon in the New Yorker magazine the year after Neil Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin walked on the moon. And in this cartoon, Christopher Columbus is standing in front of Queen Isabella, and she's saying to him, three ships is a lot of ships. Can't you prove the world is round with one ship? And that right there sums up the fact that it's a pretty rare time when a society is willing to spend the multiple billions of dollars that we did going to the moon. And of course, on that tidal wave of exploration came missions like Voyager and Viking and so many of the others that we now look back on. I think we're now at a crossroads where we have to learn to do not only human spaceflight, but robotic spaceflight in a way that is affordable and sustainable. Having said that, we also need to reverse the very draconian budget cuts that have been levied against NASA's planetary program. And for that, I would invite you, I
yes,
would actually
applaud. Go
urge
crazy.
You. Hold on. Anybody within the sound of my voice, go to planetary.org/get-involved and send an email to Congress and say, we must explore.
And grand ideas have the effect of pulling people together because they can see a sense of purpose. I think that obviously scientifically, Mars sample return's the next thing to do. I think that we are at a tipping point in human exploration that some people realize and others don't, where things, companies like SpaceX and the other winners of this commercial crew are going to provide a capability that will expand the number of people who've been to space by orders of magnitude. And I think it's going to become a shared experience as opposed to something that where we see a tiny, small group doing. And it's going to become more us. And I think as us becomes a spacefaring nation and a spacefaring world, it'll become part of our common experience.
And that will raise our expectations of what's possible. And that will make the world better for everyone.
Andy, I want to give you the last word.
Hope and excitement are the antidotes to fear and insularity, and exploration is all about excitement and hope and what makes us feel really alive as humans. So let's go, Curiosity.
Yeah, absolutely.
Space historian and author Andrew Chaikin, joined by former NASA Mars program leader Scott Hubbard and Planetary Society CEO Bill Nye, the Science Guy. There's another 25 minutes of our conversation that we couldn't fit into the broadcast version of the show. It includes a lot of great audience questions we took at Planet Fest just before Curiosity's landing. You can hear it at planetary.org/radio or wherever our podcast can be found. Bruce Betts is up next. So we're back at the Planetary Society this week. It's time for What's Up with Bruce Betts. The best of the excitement is over the landing, although certainly the excitement continues with Curiosity.
Oh, it does. Now we actually do the science part.
Oh, that's right. There was all of
there
that.
Was, there is another part of the mission, turns out. It's a wee bit slower and more methodical.
I'm ready to jump up and down and continue cheering when, you know, Kim Cam zaps a rock or a Martian or something.
And how about those images?
They're beautiful. They're beautiful.
They're beautiful, man. Hey, speaking of Mars, you can see it, your very self, with your very own eyes in the evening sky. Now, it's a cool little cluster going on in the evening sky over in the west-southwest, pretty low down, but in the early evening you can check out Mars, and it just passed through, it lined up with Spica, the bluish star that was below it, Mars, reddish, and Saturn, yellowish above it, and now they're forming, not surprisingly, a triangle.
Hard to avoid.
Being three of them not lined up anymore.
Yeah.
But all kind of clustered. And if you pick up this show right after it comes out on the 21st, they are hanging out with the moon too, forming more of a rectangle-y square thing.
You said Mars is the reddish one, the one with the new little six-wheeled thing on it.
Yeah, well, just look for Curiosity. That's the one with Mars. Yeah, that's Mars. In the pre-dawn, there's also a groovy brightness going on. We've still got Jupiter and Venus there, Venus being the brighter, lower-down object in the east, Jupiter higher above, and just making for a lovely kind of collaboration. That's not the right word. But yeah, if they work, they're collaborating together with Orion, and the Orion constellation is over to the right, to use a technical term from the planets, and it's the top of Orion. It's like Orion sticking his, wait, that's going to sound odd, but Orion sticking his head up in between Venus and
where the sun
Jupiter.
Don't shine.
No. It's just his head. He's looking around at the planets. So anyway, moving on to this week in space history. It was a Voyager 2 really liked doing things during this week in space history. 35 years ago, 1977, Voyager 2 launched. 4 years later, 1981, did its flyby of Saturn, and during this week. And then another, I can do math, 8 years later, it flew by Neptune in 1989 during this week.
Random space fact.
That was lovely. But also, here is the same kind of musical rendition from our friends in the High Fidelity Quartet.
Random space fact. Space fact.
Wow, you really worked to make me sound really, really bad.
You do pale by comparison,
wow.
I'm afraid.
Thanks for that. All hail High Fidelity. That was impressive. So Gale Crater, it's been in the news lately. You may have heard about it. It's where that Curiosity thing we mentioned landed, in Gale Crater. It is 154 kilometers in diameter. That's about 96 miles. That's big. In terms of the area of Gale Crater, it's about the combined area of Connecticut and Rhode Island. So I'm going to propose that we make it a state.
I don't want to lose 50, because 51 is just not as classy. Can we drop Rhode Island, maybe, and make...
I guess we'll find out if we have any Rhode Island listeners. I mean, seriously, it's really small. Why don't we combine it? We can have a nice short name state, Connecticut, Rhode Island. Rhode Connecticut Island.
That's a good idea. Right.
Yeah, I'm just full of good ideas today. Let us go on to the trivia contest. I had mentioned to you that the International Astronomical Union had given the official name Aeolus Mons to the mountain in Gale Crater that will be the target of Curiosity after it landed, but that NASA has been applying an unofficial name, which I've been fascinated that they continue to apply in their press conferences and otherwise. And I asked, what is that name? And who was it named after? How'd we do, Matt?
Really big response to this. But it was Ron Brown who got chosen by random.org, and he said the unofficial name, that unofficial name, Mount Sharp. And as you know, and as we were also told by Rennie Christopher, Mount Sharp, named that by NASA after the geologist Dr. Robert Sharp, best known for once having been celebrity planetary radio announcer Bruce Betts's professor.
Yes, I'm sure that's how everyone thinks of him.
Rennie also mentions that, he may have lost a mountain, but he's gained a crater, because I guess there was a nearby crater?
Yes. It's a whole terminology thing. Officially, in terminology land, you can name craters after people on Mars, but you cannot name mountains after people on Mars. But they're still calling it Mount Sharp. Yeah, I did field geology with the man.
You and a couple of other listeners. I mean, one of them was Bob Myers, who also had him as a Caltech geology professor, and there was at least one other, although I didn't pull that one in. So he must have been quite a guy.
He was darned impressive, the way it take you to all the lovely hell holes that geologists like to visit, and then just read the terrain around you. And it was like geomorphology god. He also has a couple of really cool books, at least a couple of geology and Southern California field guides. So if you're ever down here and feel like staring at cliff faces and the like, he's got some great guides that you can follow on your drives.
Nice that you feel so good about him, you who is more astronomer than geologist.
It's true, and I learned that by hanging out with people like Bob Sharp.
My geologist.
Although the geomorphology I could handle. It was the rock name, the obsessive rock naming. That was where I was.
And astronomers have comfortable chairs.
it's true. And they when they are sleeping, they often sleep in beds. I like that part.
No, it's scorpions.
Cool. God, I hated those things.
We're going to send Ron Brown a Fisher space pen. Inscribed, engraved with Planetary Radio, cool. The Planetary Society. Let's give somebody else a chance to win one of those.
All right. So if you want to stay home in your bed, but you want to send a robotic geologist to Mars, let's say, for example, Curiosity. In fact, let's say Curiosity. How long an arm do you put on it? Okay, let me be clearer. How long is the reach of the MSL Curiosity arm from the front of the rover body?
Okay.
Go to planetary.org/radio, find out how to enter.
Good one. You have until, let's see, what would it be, the 27th of August, 2012, at 2 p.m. Pacific time to get us this answer.
All right, everybody, go out there, look up the night sky, and think about pohoihoi and ah-ah.
Oh, mahalo.
Mahalo. Mahalo.
It's good to be back from vacation and sitting across from Bruce Betts, the Director of Projects for the Planetary Society. He joins me every week for What's Up? Planetary Radio is produced by the Planetary Society in Pasadena, California, and made possible by the Kenneth T. and Eileen L. Norris Foundation and by the members of the Planetary Society. We also thank the sponsors of PlanetFest, including NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory, bringing the universe to you, along with landing Curiosity on Mars. Space Exploration Technologies, better known as SpaceX, designing, manufacturing, and launching the world's most advanced rockets and spacecraft. And X-Core Aerospace, new technology of space, now building the Lynx suborbital spaceship. Clear skies, everyone.